We'll now call into order a study session for Thursday, March 25th, 2010. First item on the agenda is to hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the proposed funding recommendations for fiscal year 2010-11 CDBG home ESG programs. Mr. Villa and Ms. Olson. Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Brady, that's right.
Mayor and Council, we have submitted to you last week the proposals or the process of the CDBG application process, where we had several months ago, as we typically do, annually do, put out a call for proposals for CDBG funding in different categories. This year is a fairly significant shift in some areas what we're proposing to do. And it has a couple of different factors that led to that. The first would be, first, that as you recall, over a year ago, the city was awarded $9.6 million in neighborhood stabilization program dollars. And at the direction of the city council, we worked with many nonprofits to implement that program, and at the direction of council, focused that implementation in the 85204 area. While we have been very successful and have been actually leading probably this metropolitan area in moving those projects out, and I think many of we've been on the council has seen firsthand some of the improvements that have been made in that area and that neighborhood and those projects, we are actually now getting individuals into those homes, so it's been quite a success. There is still significant amount of funds that are available, both from the original allocation as well as the way the program works. It allows for program income to continue to go back into the program to be utilized for housing projects by our partners that are working with us in the NSP program. As a result, because of that volume of, or because of those resources that are there, which are still significant and will continue to be for, certainly for the next year, far in excess of what we would ever be able to provide in any one year in the CDBG funds. Matter of fact, the housing dollars that are available still in NSP are in excess of the entire amount of the CDBG funding. So what we made a decision was that since those funds are available and we still need to continue to focus on spending those dollars and getting those dollars out the door, we really made a conscious effort to suggest that this year we probably didn't have to look at utilizing as much of the CDBG allocation for the housing programs as we have in the past, as well as those funds that we were going to be able to use, would give us an opportunity to bring on other groups to create some additional capacity in our nonprofit areas, partners to have opportunities to participate in the programs. This also helped open up opportunities for us to meet some of the stated objectives and strategies of the City Council to shift some of the priorities in CDBG funding. As you will notice, that there is less dollars, as I mentioned, in the housing and the public service area. But you will notice that in accordance with the direction that we heard from council, we have shifted about over $400,000 to both to the economic development and neighborhood services area. That is important, I think, because we heard from council about focusing on downtown. There is over $400,000 in CBG dollars that are being refocused, if you would, to the downtown programs, and this is being matched by over $250,000 from our utilities department to support some of those projects. So it leverages another $250,000. So we're with these dollars here, we're talking about another $650,000 in economic development for the downtown area. I can tell you, as we look at our budget, I can't think of any other area that's getting an increase, especially of $650,000. We're also continuing to look at code compliance and neighborhood services programs, where they continue to provide a lot of important services and outreach to those areas that are in the CDBG eligible areas. And you'll notice that there are some increases there. So that's kind of our strategy. One, we were doing our best to fulfill the direction we heard from council about committing more resources to downtown and economic development. And so you see a significant increase in that area, continuing to support neighborhoods and code enforcement. And yes, there is, and I've seen the emails, some concern about the reduction in housing, but the fact is that there is more dollars still available under NSP. Those dollars are still available and are still available to be spent and will continue to be available going into the future, which are far in excess of what we could provide under the CDBG program, which then allows us to do these programs in downtown. So with that, I'll let Carolyn and Ray.
If I could just very quickly summarize so I make sure I understand. So basically, in the past, we were using CDBG funds for housing and for trying to accomplish two things, the housing and some of the other issues, economic development, other things that we're doing now. What I'm hearing is that with the availability of other alternate funds, we can perhaps spread out that a little bit, shift some of these specific housing initiatives into the NSP funding, which it's recurring because as we sell a house, that goes back into the pot and can be reused again. And therefore, we're able to the staff's recommending that we shift some of that funding or some of the obligations onto the NSP funding source, and therefore we can pick up more direct economic development with CDBG
correct
type funding. And the reason the utilities are involved specifically in downtown is, once again, we're missing out on millions and millions of dollars a year in revenue from a downtown that is underdeveloped or undeveloped, and they have is that the logic? And
it helps obviously specifically, and we can get into it, is the area regarding fire sprinkler systems and the ability to provide for that infrastructure. So this is a program here. Let me go back. The NSP, I hear the concern that there are some that are concerned about being restricted to the 85204 area. That's a council priority. The council,
we made that
priority. If there, like I said, there's literally millions of dollars still available under NSP.
We could redefine
that.
There are no allow those same partners
to go outside of that if that's what we want to choose to do.
All right, so we can define that area. That was something we did last year with the initial.
Right.
Plan. We can redefine that to whatever area we want as long as it's consistent with the HUD guidelines.
Correct.
Okay, gotcha. All right. Any questions, Mr. Brady, before we go? Yeah, Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Just a comment, Mayor. I have to leave.
Oh, that's
shortly,
right. Okay.
And I wanted to at least voice some questions. Mr. Brady addressed some of them. Just general comments with regard to the CDBG applications. I've had a concern for a lot of years on council that the ratio of funding between the public sector side and the private sector side is very overbalanced on the public sector side. And I understand the reasons for city staff wanting to do that, but I would point out that the funds we provide to the private nonprofits leverage an incredible amount of funds from other sources and have a great multiplier effect. And so I still have the concern over the ratio. I think it's way too tilted on the city side on many services that in reality should be funded by the general fund. Obviously, again, I understand economic issues, but I think the city gets more bang for its buck as it increases the ratio to the private sector side. The other, and with regard to the CDBG applications, as a general comment, I would note that that this year we're not funding any, at least I don't think we're funding any bricks and mortar type of projects from the nonprofits. And again, I think those organizations in the city may be losing out on at least hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars in leveraged funds for projects. And that just should be an issue that we keep in the back of our mind. With regard to the home applications, again, I think Mr. Brady's probably referring to some emails I sent, because I did have a concern that the focus on the funding here is a significant change, and I think we have to look at it in concert with the housing plan that is in effect and approved for the city. Is this shift really consistent with the plan that has been in place for our community? Because NSP funds certainly are available, but there are guidelines attached in terms of how they can be spent. And I do think we need to understand that there are housing needs with all due respect to District 4, there are housing needs in the community outside of 85204. And so I hope as we continue our discussions that we look at that, and I appreciate the suggestion that it is a topic that we can look at in the future. So those are just my general comments on it, and I apologize for having to leave the meeting temporarily.
No, thank you. Councilmember Kavanaugh has a presentation he has to give at the Mesa United Way, so we'll excuse him for a few minutes. Thank you for those comments. And as we go forward on this, we'll hear a presentation. We have a very nice detailed list here, which includes staff recommendations. If we can, you know, we could go down line item by line item and go back and forth. And I don't believe the best use of our time right here. This is an information. There will be general questions. I appreciate Councilmember Kavanaugh's general comments because I think they reflect what a lot of us are thinking. I'm hoping that as we leave this, that there will be some direction that will cause perhaps some maybe some changes in this, and if so, that we'll work on that outside, and then we'll bring this back for final decision and going forward approval. But I'm not looking at final approval today of this list. I just think it's premature. Is that okay with council? Okay. So Vice Mayor Jones had a question.
I just need to ask the city attorney, and I'm sorry I didn't get with you ahead of time on this, but it stems more from what we've had in previous years. Because of company I work with, Security Alarm Systems, a number of the nonprofits are customer of that business that I work with. I want to make sure where the dividing line is of what I can participate in, because it's not every category, but some of the categories, and I just want to make sure I get a clarification again, especially since we've changed it up a little bit now, to what degree I can and cannot participate.
Okay. Mayor, Vice Mayor, as in the past, what I would ask is for you to review this list and those entities for which you have an ongoing business relationship. So if the business relationship has ended and you do not have a reasonable belief that that business relationship, you're going to have a new working relationship or a new contract with that nonprofit, that would not count. But those entities which you have an ongoing business relationship, you should not discuss or participate in the allocation of funds to those businesses. You can discuss the other applications. When we come to voting on it, we will... you and I can sit down and we can talk exactly which ones do you have a conflict on, and we'll try to carve them out of the vote so that you can participate in the vote with those entities that you do not have a conflict with, but you will not participate on the vote for the entities that you do have a conflict on.
But always to avoid any appearance of conflict, the recommendations that come to us already from the staff and board who's reviewed this, you have allocations for home, for ESG, for different areas. Are we're not going to be shifting between those areas, or the council could, at their discretion, change those allocations?
They could. And what my recommendation to you would be is that, for example, and I'm just going to pick one. If you had a conflict with the, well, let's just pick the ASU, and it's for CDBG. If you had a conflict with the ASU project, but you did not with the other CDBG applications, you could talk about the other CDBG applications, but you should not talk either in favor of or in opposition to the ASU application. When it comes to the vote, we will try and agendize it in such a way that you can participate in as much as you can.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Ray, Carolyn?
Yes.
You're on.
Okay. Good morning again. As has been mentioned, today's presentation includes the federal entitlement programs for the City of Mesa, CDBG, Home, and ESG, Community Development Block Grant, Home Investment Partnership, and the Emergency Shelter Grants. On the slide 4 indicates funding amounts for this year compared with last year's. And it has stayed level. The next slide indicates eligible activities for the CDBG program, neighborhood revitalization, acquisition, rehab, public facilities, public services, home buyer assistance, code enforcement, and economic development. The Home Investment Partnership Program is The goal is to create affordable housing for low-income households. Each award requires a 25% non-federal match for every amount that's spent. And there is a requirement of 15% that goes to CHOTOs as a set-aside. That's Community Housing Development Organizations. And the 15% is in an aggregate and is not required each year. The emergency shelter grant started in 1988, and those funds are to operate and rehab emergency shelter facilities. The Human Service Advisory Board does review and makes recommendations for distribution for those participating agencies. On slide 8 is the first part of our spreadsheet. That area lists the activities for code enforcement and slum and blight. Slide 9 indicates the economic development activities and what was requested and the recommendations. We did have two new applications this year. One was for the Destination Mesa Coordinator, and one was for the Sprinkler Assistance Program, both from the City of Mesa Economic Development Department. The next slide indicates housing needs and the recommendations, or the requests and the recommendations set forth in that particular activity category. Slide 11 indicates public facilities that applied in that area. Slide 12 indicates a portion of the public service activities that were applied for. Slide 12 and slide 13, with the total being on slide 13. Slide 14 indicates the administration for the CDBG program. Slide 15 indicates the home projects that were requested and recommendations. Slide 16 indicates CHOTO's application requests as well as funding recommendations and also administration of the program. Slide 17 indicates the ESG program, and those are our shelters that we have typically funded in the past here in the City of Mesa. And slide 18 indicates the public comment period, which begins March 31st and will end April 30th. There is a public hearing number 2, which will be held on April 19th. And any comments submitted will be forwarded to the council and to HUD through our annual plan. Slide 19 indicates actions that will need to be taken on the April 19th council meeting. Approval of the annual plan, the consolidated plan, and approval of the analysis of impediments to fair housing, which is a document required by HUD. Every 5 to 10 years, they require that. Slide 20 does indicate again the council meeting on April 19th and what will go on then. Okay, questions?
If I'm reading this correctly, as I look at the total funding request for this year, it's about $7.4 million. I'm looking at the page 3 of your... am I reading that right? There in the two-thirds of the way down the page. And we estimate we're going to have about level funding or $3.4 million in funds available. So... you know, we've got basically almost a $4 million difference between the funding requests and the actual amount that we have to divvy out.
That's correct.
Okay. Looks like the most of those differences, the majority of those differences come from the housing needs and the public facility. I think that's a one-shot deal, that $725,000. But getting back to the housing needs and what you said, what you explained, Mr. Brady, is that, can that $2 million or $2.5 million, let me see, it's more than that. About $4 million was requested, and we basically have just a little over $1 million. So almost $3 million in housing difference. And it's obvious from what, listening to what Mr. Brady said, that we purposefully did not use CDBG funds to satisfy the requests in housing because we believe that we can satisfy those needs, or is it a one-for-one trade-off, or are these a little different? Can we cover those with NSP, or is that a different type of housing approach in NSP? Does that make any sense at all?
Well, let's talk about the NSP, what the NSP program does. Maybe Ray or Carolyn can walk through what all the variety of things NSP does, and
well,
is there
I don't need that detailed of an explanation, just on a general basis.
I can give you to it. I think I can give you in 2 seconds. NSP is acquiring homes, rehabbing them, and finding new owners. Some of the other housing activities is rehabbing homes for existing homeowners that are low income.
So they're both housing, but they're not I mean, that's okay. I just want to know.
Yeah,
they're not exactly the
program.
Same. It's a housing program, but it's a little bit different twist on a housing program. Okay, that's all I needed to know. All right. It's not an apples to apples, but it's apples to apple cider. Is that close enough? It's all housing, but it's just a little different approach to it. Okay. That's thank you, Councilman Richens. Any other questions? Councilman Richens.
Kind of a philosophical thing that I wanted to throw out. I know that we've for a long time talked about getting out of the housing business and have never really well defined what that meant. And I think it's time this year that we probably should define what that means and develop some kind of plan associated with approval of this document about how that's going to occur. We need to build capacity in our community to do more. And Chris nailed it in his opening. Is that a monologue? His opening introduction to this.
it was funny.
We do.
It was as funny as Jay Leno's monologue. So.
but building capacity within our community by both the for-profit and non-profit communities to do these kind of activities, and I know that I got to give credit to to Ravia and Carolyn, that they've been working with nonprofits very well under NSP, and I think that's been a great program to help build capacity. But I think we need to, you know, we have a housing plan, we have these plans. We need to see some kind of a plan or a RFP or some kind of process that helps define what that really means for this council to get us out of the housing business so we can better define it. One of the things that I see occurring, and I have kind of watched it over the last decade, that happens in Mesa, and it happens in other communities, so we're not the only one guilty of it, but we use CDBG dollars to supplant general fund dollars instead of supplement general fund dollars. And the principle of CDBG is to give an additional pot of money to a city for reinvestment in low and moderate income areas that are struggling, maybe have older infrastructure. And because of the budget crisis that Mesa chronically deals with over the last decade, we've had to supplant dollars there. So instead of saying, okay, well, we can afford in our general fund 5 code compliance officers, and because we have particular code problems in this area, we're going to supplement those 5 with 2 more funded by CDBG. Instead, only CDBG-funded code officers work instead of CDBG-eligible areas, and they work out other sides. And Tammy Albright, I have to give huge kudos to for how she manages that program and make sure that it's done fairly and well. You know, another example is the Washington Activity Center, that when we could no longer fund that in our general fund, we decided to push that out of our general fund and then fund it through CDBG. And so it's supplemented, it's supplanted instead of supplemented. And I think that goes against the principle of what HUD is trying to accomplish with CDBG, and it's something that we need to, in addition to having a plan about how we're going to get out of the housing business and what we really mean by that, but also talk about how CDBG needs to be supplementing these low and moderate income areas instead of supplanting general fund dollars. Thanks.
Thank you. Councilmember Summers.
I'll start off with answering a little bit about my perspective on getting out of the housing business, because that is one of the questions we asked. From my perspective, we were talking about that in the context of what we want to do with Escobedo. Do we want to be in providing direct service, managing, owning, and renting out a property in Escobedo to Lodemont Income? And the answer on the, I think, the previous council and this council, once it took office, was that we did not want to do that. From my perspective, I don't think we ever talked about not wanting to be a player in helping a lot of the non-governmental organizations in their mission in rehabbing housing, providing low-mod housing, and certainly a portion of building the Better Mesa has to be to ensure that our housing stock is adequate to the need and really a value to the neighborhood. As far as supplanting general fund dollars, I think it's a bit of a slippery slope in that we just don't have the money to hold those positions. So as we continue to cut to make sure that we have a balanced budget, those positions go away. Were it not for CDBG, we wouldn't have those positions at all. In some ways, that's supplementing the budget. In other ways, you may be supplanted. I guess it just depends on your point of view. What's interesting and important is what the council wants to focus on. When I first took office only 4 years ago, and maybe even farther back, the vice mayor might have some insight, it really focused a lot on social services. Because of the reduction in our budget, but also a decline in some of the CDBG dollars, we started to really try to focus in on emergency services. That is, what agencies do our police officers, our firefighters, and to some extent what Ray Villa's office deals with, which of those agencies are really important to them? Because if we couldn't shift some money through CDBG to those agencies, like emergency shelters would be an example, then our emergency services officers, our police officers and firefighters would be forced to deal with that. Now there's been a shift, and I support it, with Mayor Smith coming on, toward looking at not only the emergency services, but some economic development and a focus on downtown. The idea being you can hand somebody a fish and they'll feed them for a day, but you teach them to fish, you feed them for a lifetime. That is, how do we create jobs with CDBG? And I think that looking at overall what staff has recommended here, there's a lot of opportunities to remove some barriers that have been an obstruction to growth, particularly in the downtown area in the 85204, but the creating jobs that these folks are really going to need and all of us could really use. One thing I would ask, and this will conclude my comment, is the CDBG has a very restricted area where we can use it. If we can get a map to show, show folks who are right now just riveted to Channel 11, so they know that this isn't something that you can use, for example, in most of Northeast Mesa or Southeast Mesa. There's actually a fairly small area for CDBG. But that doesn't necessarily carry over with the other grants, right? That's a CDBG. It has that area. The home grants we could spread out. Neighborhood Stabilization Program, another home housing project, could go anywhere if we so chose, correct?
Yes, as long as it meets certain HUD requirements, we can go outside of that area.
Yeah, that's kind of what I figured. Okay. Thank you, Mayor. Those are my comments.
Councilmember Higgins.
Mayor, thank you. Kind of to echo Councilmember Richens, I was just adding some quick numbers, and I think we have like $3.4 million, is that it-ish?
Correct.
And $1.8 of it is going to the city of Mesa. And kind of to tie to Councilmember Kavanaugh, too, where we really, I think it's disproportionate city funds versus the nonprofits, and we are losing that ability to multiply the money like a nonprofit can do where the city doesn't. Also, in this, I see a lack of funding for senior areas. It seems like we're more in that, you know, we're more in the home ownership and individual homes where there's some issues with the disabled community and senior type activities that we aren't addressing. Thanks.
Councilman Fender.
Thank you, Mayor. I appreciate all the good work you do. I can feel the underlying stress, as we will through this whole budget process and all the different departments and divisions, of so little money, so much need. I can also tell that seeing in this process, there's things that stand out that are very important to me that, you know, I look at different services that are provided that would be much different than many of my other fellow council members. So my question would be to the mayor. At some point, we'll need to, as a council member, go through this process, probably offline, not in a public hearing, but meet with staff to try and understand their logic and reasoning behind the decisions or the suggestions that they're making. And then will we come back without breaking a line item down? How will we do this process to be able to find a consensus?
Well, and I think you raise a good point. I think what we... Obviously, there are specific line items that we may or may not have questions on. If we don't have questions on, then it doesn't really matter, that you'll have questions on. And it's not that we don't want to discuss it here. I think once again, this was for introduction and to talk philosophy. I would suggest that if you have a specific item or group of items, that you talk with Mr. Brady and staff and get additional information on it. And then we'll need to come back and because I need to chew on a little bit of this too and better understand how each of these line items fit in with the general philosophies that have been discussed today. And then we talk about it. Then when we come back, we're going to have one more session where we will talk about specific items if we have to. But hopefully what we can do is you can get questions answered, and then we can, if there are specific line items that we as a council want to redirect, we'll make that decision in the follow-up meeting, but we won't have to talk about the whole philosophy and everything. Councilman Richards.
One question. What effect do any changes to this recommended list have on the public hearing process? Does it have to be?
No, I mean, we've actually done it where we keep going through the public hearing process with this, and then council on the night, like the 19th or before the 19th, can start working on their changes.
Yeah, and remember, if we talk about specific line items, what you're doing is you're shifting from my...
Right.
Because the pot is $3.4 million.
Right.
And the pot on the NSP is $9.6 million.
Right.
And if we're gonna change as a council individual line items, it's going to be within that $3.4 million. So you're going to take from one line and put it to another line, and you're going to add and reduce within the $3.4
million. May I add? I mean, we there's still a $300 million general fund, and I know the 70% of that goes to public safety, and it's a very tight amount of money. Yeah. But I would like to also add that it may not just be within that $3.4 million. On the city side stuff, we're making the spending priorities for that pot general fund money. So if we decide that something in there should be funded by the general fund, we'll have ledger shifts to happen on that side of
it. Right,
and it can shift out of this CDBG and into
it can.
General fund.
And if you remember last year, and we had a good discussion about that, and I think we need to revisit that every year, because the nature of grants is that if we decide to not fund something with a general fund, whether it's supplement or supplant, that's a year-to-year deal. I mean, those are not recurring funds. We have to look at it that way, because they're grant monies, and grant monies only come every year. And, you know, CDBG could be eliminated, or it may be reduced, or whatever. So I think as we look at it, this isn't simply we have this pot of money over here, which is general fund money, and we have this pot of money, which is CDBG money, and, we can take one program and fund it out of here, because, for example, Washington Center, or the code compliance. We made the decision last year in the budget, because we had this discussion, that we were going, that was important enough for us to put those additional code compliance officers in CDBG, knowing that that may be a one-shot deal because it's a grant issue. And I think, you know, it's we need to put it in context where we're talking general fund versus CDBG, because they really are two different approaches. We made a very conscious decision last year on Washington Rec Center to fund through CDBG with the full knowledge and understanding that funding may not be available beyond that. And as a matter of fact, I think the instruction was to everyone in that area, you better start looking for perhaps alternatives because this may not be here anymore. And I think with any CDBG-funded initiative, we have to look at it as a one-year deal with no ongoing commitments. You know, in general fund, it's a little different because you're looking at programs that are that you assume will be ongoing programs, or if they're not, we know that they're one-shot capital. On an operations, I don't know many situations in general fund where we look at something and we say, oh, we're going to just fund this for 1 year. We generally look at funding a program that's going to be a recurring, ongoing type program. And so I agree that we need to look at that, but want to make sure that we do it with our eyes wide open, that there are significant differences between the objective and the attitude that we need to take when we're looking at sure. general fund versus CDBG. Am I off base on
no,
that?
No, no, but I also would caution the council is that one of the other philosophies and that has been employed with the city budget is to say that though if there are services that are being provided in the CDBG eligible areas, whether it's code compliance or whether it's related to neighborhoods and now the direction from council on economic development, we have tried to find ways to have the CDBG funds help fund those, recognizing, yes, I mean, and Washington was one where we tried to save it,
yes.
to keep it going. There have been other projects that say, you know, we don't have the capacity in the general fund to do it, but maybe the CDBG funds can help, can provide
those.
I
don't think that's contrary to what I
right.
just said, because
right.
once again, we look at Washington, we had a specific need in a specific area. And I do believe, getting back to what Councilmember Summers said, if Washington were, and we made this decision, if it were in an area that did not require that type of special care, we would not have made that decision. We made the decision because it was an area that demanded special interest, just like the additional code compliance. I think the reason why we wanted to use CDBG is that there was an additional need. Now, whether we call that supplement or supplant, I mean, you know, I don't know. I don't know how to do it. It really depends on what view you're looking at, because I could see it being looked at it both ways. But I think where CDBG comes from, and code compliance is a good example, we believe that in the older areas of Mesa where blight was an issue, where code compliance was a huge challenge, we decided that fit in perfectly with what CDBG was meant to do, which was to give it a shot in the arm in that specific area, knowing that that funding may not be there the next year. Then we would be faced with the priority, which is this significant enough and do we have the resources available within the general fund to now reallocate resources, general fund resources, to that area? I mean, that's a decision we go through every year. If we can use CDBG, that's great because we don't have to go through that process.
Because most likely right now, obviously, we're in a very much of a retraction mode in the general
yeah.
fund. Significantly,
and yet we have ongoing, if not increasing, needs in the specific areas that are targeted by CDBG.
Right, and we kind of look at these. Frankly, we look at all sources when we're doing our programs, whether it's general fund, CDBG, recognizing they have a little bit different animal, but we do look at them as opportunities to provide these services that the council has outlined as important, and trying to bring them and still keep them going over a period of time.
Yeah, and I hope we don't, though, get lulled into, like, even code compliance, and I'll agree with Councilmember Richens on this, that we don't get lulled into the fact that since we've funded two or four or however many it is code compliance office out of CBG, that somehow that's a recurring, as if it's a general fund, because I would agree that that's not the proper use of CBG, which means that we as a council need to sit down every year and decide, okay, are we going to go one more year? Is this still an ongoing need? Rather than, boy, thank heavens, we got relief from general fund. I mean, is that really what you're getting at?
Yeah.
I mean, I think we need to look at it on a year-by-year basis to make sure it's accomplishing the purpose for which we had decided to throw it into CDBG to begin with, which was we have a blighted area, we have
right.
a compliance area that really needs a shot in the arm. We don't. We either don't have or we're really struggling to find general fund monies to handle this. Thank heavens we have CDBG that we can now cover this and get that shot in the arm. Councilmember Ridge and then Councilmember Summers.
The Washington Park is a great, I think, opportunity for this year. I know that staff has made effort to find somebody to operate that center instead of having staff or CDBG have to fund it. And so I think that's a great example of capacity building where you've had a long established existing neighborhood. are there entities within there? Is there something that we can put together this year, like an RFP or some capacity building initiative that can go and help develop an entity to operate that and then take that off CDBG, but wean it off over?
Well, I think last year we had the discussion we were going to wean it off, and maybe it was a little unfair to give people 1 year, but I think last year, if you remember,
Mayor, this is the third year of funding. We actually did try that. Yeah. We brought in several groups, the YMCA and other groups, to try to do it, and they're really just, it's not of a scale and capacity,
right.
And there's not the capacity in the community to pay for the fees that would support it. And last year we made the decision again to fund them from CDBG. So this is actually the third year of funding from CDBG. It is a dilemma. We are in a difficult situation. Many of these programs, most likely, while they are, yes, could be provided in the general fund, they would not be provided in the general
right.
fund. That we would not be able to do these.
But once again, the only reason why we're talking CDBG is not because we simply can't fund them, but because they're in areas
that really scream out
for the program because it's in a
right.
challenged area.
And I would suggest that while, you know, HUD has said different things at different times, they're definitely in the mode today. The federal government definitely is in the mode today. They have changed their tone. They're
right.
doing whatever they can to save jobs in cities, whatever the funding might be, whether it's CDBG, whether
especially
it's
COPS, in areas that are challenged.
Yeah, and so while, yeah, I understand the concern about comparing this to general fund, I would suggest to you over the last 3 years across the country, not just Mesa, that has definitely changed. The federal government is, while it may have had hesitancies in before, they recognize now that this is a way to keep these jobs, these services in these communities that need it, and these kind of services. But we can certainly make a choice. But again, it comes down to, it's really not so much, I guess, the way it's funded. Is this the priority of how council wants to spend the funds in neighborhoods
right.
or code or whatever? I just don't see, without significant changes in other opportunities or revenues or other cuts in the general fund, that these could be pushed back to the general fund.
Councilmember Summers.
I just want to, Mayor, I agree with your points in that, I mean, some of what you look at on what these project programs are, there are funding for positions. Code enforcement has some of those positions at some point. While I would agree that we could start funding with these with CDBG dollars because of the areas, we're going to have to start looking at some point down the road and transferring those off of this and onto the general fund. If they're that important to the community, they should be part of the general fund. There's another position in here that using CDBG is absolutely appropriate. At some point, if that turns out to be an important position and we want to maintain it, should be moved to the general fund at some point. Other issues in here are one time as well. Here, there are several in here for studies over the last couple of years that were funded in 2009-10 and are not part of the 2010-11. So funding changes, we look at projects, we fund them 1 year. Some of them are gone the next. Others, I agree, we need to shift to the general fund, and still others are probably we need to look at and determine whether we should be in that business anymore.
And we'll get to Councilmember Fenter. Just something real quick, and I think that getting back to the whether we're in the housing business or not, I think we're talking two different things but the same thing. Because I agree with you that on its most base level, the city of Mesa decided it didn't want to be a landlord and got out of the Escobedo landlord business. And I'm not sure that that's what Councilmember Richens, and I'm stating this to make sure I understand it. I think what we're saying is that in the rehab and other things, the question is the city going to be the one that goes out and provides the business, or is the city going to be the conduit that then farms out or attracts and then farms out money to nonprofits, private, so that we can leverage what they have to bring, and therefore we take more of an administrative role than an active participant role. Is that what you were alluding
to? That is correct. Thank you, Mayor. Because we're the recipient of CDBG funds from the federal government, we have to have expertise developed within our staff to be able to monitor those programs, make sure that we're compliant, and that we don't get federal government.
And when you're talking about getting out of the housing business, you're talking about us actually going out and doing the rehab and doing that versus ABC ABC nonprofit doing.
Right, right. Okay. I mean, it's one thing to have...
I hope there's not an ABC nonprofit out there somewhere.
It's one thing to fund our staff to do the contract management that we do, and compared to, you know, I think we're fairly efficient in how we're doing our contract management. We had 40 contracts last year, and you do the math, and it's, you know, about $14,000 or $15,000 per contract, and... Then there's other money to do project delivery and project management for these rehabs that are going on, and that's the kind of the dollars that I question. Can we be more efficient in that? Some nonprofits will leverage the CDBG dollars, 5-to-1, 4-to-1, 10-to-1, depending on 2-to-1, depending on what the program is, and getting that leverage and those additional dollars is a missed opportunity if we're not getting that on the street.
Councilmember Fenter.
Thanks. And if you, Mr. Brady, if you can just remind me again the harsh realities as we start this overall budget process, especially speaking of the general fund, is we are starting with, the last I heard was a $19 million deficit. So that's the hurdle we have to overcome. And so I know that all has to be considered when we talk about shifting things from CDBG to general fund. And we're starting way in a difficult position, and it's all, that's the filter I put everything through.
Yeah. Can we do one thing in this budget process? We really don't have a deficit.
Yeah, clarify.
Yeah, we do not have a deficit. We have enough money, because a deficit, and I know we're using semantics here, but I think it's really important, because I get a lot of feedback as to, is the city of Mesa going to be able to pay its bills? No, we do not have a deficit. We have a difference, and if you want to call it a shortfall or whatever, between our budgeted revenues and our budgeted expenses. These are prospective. These are in the future, and we're planning for in the future. We say we expect these revenues to come in, and we have committed these expenditures. And right now what we're talking about in that $19 million is that we right now have budgeted $19 million more revenue than we expect. Now whether
we have, well, Mayor, can I just, we have forecasted revenues.
That come in short of what our committed budget is.
So I understand what the councilman is saying.
Yeah,
I think, councilman, your point is well taken. And the councilman brings councilman Fender brings a very good point, and it's what I have to, I deal with every day now as we're trying to put together a package to bring to the council, is the pressure to meet that shortfall and how to readjust our expenses going forward. And when you look at these departments that are called code compliance or called neighborhood services, the capacity to reduce them is with people. It's positions, and so many of those same positions and many of those services certainly fall within the eligibility of CDBG. And so we, sometimes many times faced with the option of saying these are great programs that we know can be funded here in CDBG. We tried to find a way to limit that, but they are providing a critical service and right into the CDBG eligibility areas. And I do think they bring. When we say bring leverage, nonprofits bring leverage, I think anybody who's been to one of our Building Stronger Neighborhoods programs sees that we bring a tremendous amount of outside resources. It is not a one-for-one dollar. We probably leverage as much as any organization what we bring to the table outside of what the city dollars are. If you walk around those rooms and those cafeterias, you see nonprofits from many different areas that are now participating. Obviously, what's difficult in code compliance is we only have one officer who serves outside the CDBG area. I mean, without CDBG, we would practically not have a code compliance program in the city of Mesa. So we are trying, and this is historic. I mean, we've been funding CDBG for years. We get the balance. We understand the challenge. But it is sometimes faced with going without for some of these programs, yet I think they provide a critical service inside these areas. Some of the programs we've offered that was the impression we received the direction from council, we had the choice of either funding, a position in economic development or in the general fund or doing it here, and that was the direction to do it here. We get it. There's a lot of opportunities. I think we just need to evaluate how we shift these and move these around. Our biggest shift here was, and we really felt like in this time when we were challenged with the funding for economic development in neighborhoods, that because of the NSP program and where it is in place today and the fairly large sums of dollars that are available, that served as a great opportunity to allow us to not have to use the CBG monies for the housing this year, maybe even next year, because we have more than funds than we've ever had available for many of these nonprofits that get funding here that are now available for them to spend through NSP. And if they're concerned about being limited to spending in a certain area, then let's sit back and
find
another way to expand that. But we are trying to find ways to provide services that we see. And these are programs. I think the good news is we're also funding programs that have a track record that I think the council has seen have a real positive impact. I think our neighborhood services programs, our Building Stronger Neighborhoods, our I can't remember the group that goes out with the prosecutors and the police and the fire and goes out and do the community action teams, have a significant impact. They are
which hopefully save us money.
And they are linked with the community. They are our primary link with our neighborhood associations out there. We don't really have another group in the city of individuals, of employees that have that one-on-one relationship with our neighborhood. So these are tough choices. The choices don't become easier if we choose not to do these, because the general fund is becoming more and more.
Well, if I could, let's get back and just to clarify, just to go back on the deficit, and maybe no one else cares, but I always get feedback. You made an interesting point about the forecast. The reason I want to say deficit implies that you're playing catch up.
Right.
That somehow you're scrambling to cover something that, oh my gosh, this money isn't here. And what we're looking at is in the future, forecast. We're looking at adjusting so that when we get to that day, we're completely in balance.
Bring it home. We're here March 25th. We're talking about a forecast of shortfall that doesn't begin until July 1.
Until July 1. Yeah, and that's something that a lot of people miss.
Yeah.
Vice Mayor, you want to comment right now?
Sure. I just want to jump in here, too. We're historical evolution of how we've used and we always use the acronym CDBG, let's say, Community Development Block Grants. There are criteria that come with it of things you can use it for. There are areas that you are restricted on how you can use it. It has to meet a criteria of income and so forth. That's always strings are tied to grant money. When I first came on council, we were using those development block grants to do streetlights in neighborhoods, to upgrade neighborhoods. We were doing different programs, but as our general fund dollars shrank and available resources shrank, we made a conscious shift a few years ago to focus more on emergency services for human services that, again, whether it was supplant or otherwise, supplement. And it's all semantics. It was shifting of those funds into other areas. Now, we're shifting again where now there was an influx of money that was specifically for housing, and that has eased that pressure, so to speak, in certain areas with different groups. So we're talking philosophically now, where are we going to put our money? But we still have that specific need on code compliance. We still have that need of taking care of services within those neighborhoods that still fall under that criteria. And it's interesting, we fall back, we got Escobedo in this conversation. It really wasn't the block grant money tied to that. That was our general fund dollars. But we made a conscious decision several years ago that, again, we were not going to be the landlord. We would administer Section 8 housing and those sorts of things, but we were not going to be the landlord. Now, what we're talking about philosophically now is how are we wanting to focus these block grants? And for me personally, when we're trying to do a philosophical approach here, I want to see more leverage with our outside groups, our nonprofits who have a history and a good track record to make those things happen. And I will agree, I don't particularly want to be the city being the one who's administering the rehab and doing all the contracting. We need to administer the program, manage the program, but I think we need to let other people actually do the rehab and so forth.
And Mayor Council, let me clarify. I don't know how many carpenters or plumbers, electricians that we have on staff do rehab.
We're contracting.
No, we are project managers oversight. We contract out many Mesa contractors to do the work. But right. In order to make sure that they are complying with the HUD regulations, we probably need a better job explaining that program.
Yeah,
we privatize a lot of that work out. These dollars, and then we then go through a procurement process to have contractors go do the work. But we still have to have it our inspectors and our project managers to make sure it complies with HUD regulations,
right.
So that our contractors can come in, do the work, and get out, and they don't have to be doing all the paperwork related to the HUD regulations. But we've got to make sure they comply with the wage requirements that come down from HUD and the procurement process.
Yeah, I think we're getting a little bit off the track because we're talking about something that, although it's related to this, is more NSP.
No, this is the housing
well,
rehab.
Let me back up. Yeah, I misspoke. I'm sorry. Thank you for jumping all over that. I appreciate that. What I meant to say is that, to me, the question as far as who's doing the work is, are we the one that's hiring the contractor? And, Dave, please correct me if I'm misstating. I'm sure you will, but anyway. Are we the one that's hiring the contractor, or are we turning it over once again to ABC nonprofit and they hire? Is that generally how it works doesn't work?
That's the discussion.
And then
that's right.
Who
right
do we manage?
Right there.
Do we manage the contractor, or do we manage the nonprofit who hires the contractor?
Well, we hire the contractor and manage that process, and we fund the repairs.
Correct.
And when
we talk about getting out of the housing business, is that what you'd like to change?
Yeah, because if you can get that out into there are nonprofits and for-profits engaged in those activities that can bring leverage to that.
So what you're saying is rather than us hire the contractor, we would contract with ABC nonprofit and they would hire the contractor and we would manage ABC nonprofit, but they would hire the contractor and leverage that, and hopefully they could do more with the amount of money. Is that what I'm hearing?
That was exactly my statement a few minutes ago.
Well, and it seems we're coming around. I just want to make sure.
We're talking philosophical here, and that was exactly where I was headed.
I want to be really careful. I'm not saying that because we don't do a good job.
Right.
Our guys do a great job, and they've done a phenomenal job with NSP. We're getting recognized nationally for the work that we've done with NSP. It's not an issue of whether or not we're doing a great job or an efficient job. It's goes to a political philosophy that feels that private sector entities should be engaged in these kind of activities more so than government. And that's just where...
And that's because you believe we can get more for the same, or is that just a...
Yeah, the feeling is the private sector can deliver services more efficiently than public sector, although sometimes, you know, in the case of solid waste, we're pretty darn efficient. But it is that general thing of that philosophy.
Mayor, we're open to continuing to strengthen that and look for nonprofits to do that.
Yeah, now, whether we do that, the $600,000 is still the same. The question is, how do we leverage that?
It's taking that out. And I think there's two things that they're asking is that if we were going to bring new partners on, they can't just be coming to spend the money like we're spending it.
Right.
What you're saying is they've got to
demonstrate
they have other dollars. The one thing we have to be careful with, it sounds great, we're going to bring in a private sector or nonprofit to do this work. They are still going to live under the great big shadow of the federal government
right.
and compliance. So they don't really get out there. This is not a privatization
no.
program.
No.
It is having a nonprofit or someone else who's then going to have to comply with these rules and regulations. And here's where we struggle is, how far do we step out of that process in oversight and making sure there's compliance in the reporting to HUD? Because HUD doesn't really care who is reporting and who's complying, or how compliance is, we're ultimately responsible. So we have to find someone who has the capacity to do that. And there are groups out there. One of the reasons that you see that we've added different groups in the housing is we're trying to develop more than just the same groups that keep coming back to us that are even in NSP, because we want to create that capacity. A lot of these groups, though, are very much interested in doing kind of the project management, get the dollars out the door, but they are not necessarily have the capacity or the experience to continue doing that reporting and oversight that HUD requires.
Yeah, and sometimes it's actually less efficient for us to manage somebody else if we have to hold their hand and we have to step in
right.
and spend a lot of extra time, energy, and effort and money managing a process because they can't do it than it is for us to do it ourselves. So we've got to be careful as to who we let.
But, if we never push that out the door, we never build that capacity. Well, I agree. And so what our goal is to take these dollars and see how many more partners we can bring in to execute some of these programs.
Yeah, and in my conversations that I've had with revitalization, they get that and they're working towards that. It's going to take time. We need to be patient with that process. And Ray has really been out there trying to bring other entities from around the valley, from around the state, from around the nation, people that will do these kind of activities. But it's going to take us some time.
Okay.
When you talk about CDCs, Pittsburgh has 50 CDCs around the entire. We have one or two. You know, we just don't have the capacity. So we need to encourage neighborhoods to organize and get together and build that capacity within them and take accountability for things happening in their neighborhood so the city doesn't have to act like a big HOA. People who live in these, my neighborhood needs to be accountable for what happens in our neighborhood. And, you know, over time, I think we can get there. We just need to trust our neighbors, and then we need to train our neighbors. Then we need to engage them to be able to do this in a real way.
Okay.
And so now that everybody has said what I tried to say philosophically, we're there.
Well, if you remember, I think if we pull out the tape from last year, we had a very similar discussion. So, and we probably will next year too, because I understand. It's tough. You got $7.5 million in requests, and you got $3 million in monies available. You're going to have to make philosophical decisions as to where you're going to where you're going to spend the money, and that's tough. And would love to not have those kind of issues. We'd love to be able to say we have plenty of resources within our general fund that we don't have to make these choices. That's not our reality right now. So I think we'll keep having these discussions because every year reality sort of slaps us in the face. And, that's just what it is. We'll deal with it. I think one thing I'd really like that Councilmember Kavanaugh brought up, just an answer, bricks and mortar. I don't know exactly what he was talking about other than it looks as though because of the limited funds, we're code compliance. We're looking at things in programs and also in housing. I wish he were here. Was he referring to the fact that we're not putting money into building facilities and stuff? Is that specifically something?
Yeah, there are a couple of applications that came in to do some rehab or to outfit a space for another organization. Or, there's like, for example, the senior services have a three-phase project that they want to do that they need to bring their kitchen and their boilers and stuff up to standard. And so they look for funding for stuff like that. There is a bricks and mortar. I think accessible space is a bricks and mortar project. So there is funding for a bricks and mortar project where that actually is a very interesting project because that's leveraging a huge amount of low-income housing tax credit dollars, I can't even begin. There's probably 6 or 7 funding sources for that project. And so that project is actually leveraging quite a bit. And that, I think, is a great example of how some of our money can go into a project and make it happen that might not otherwise happen because the funds weren't there.
And the reality is, with limited funds, I guess we're having to make a tough choice sometimes between.
Right. Well, and that's exactly the way
$600,000 of bricks and mortar right there.
That's $600,000 that we are recommending the one that counts. And talk a little bit about, because the way HUD looks at funding capital projects, we can't just fund. Was there some restriction about funding phases or funding, or do we have to fund the commitment going through, or how does that work?
We can fund phases.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. But again, it did come down to the choice. If you look at the reductions in that area, it really much corresponds with the shift over to economic development in neighborhoods. Essentially, we had to make some choices of where
If you look at our overall approach in general fund, I mean, we're moving on with capital projects, but those are bonded, specific funded. Any general fund capital projects are under serious review, and many of those, if not a good chunk of those, if they're not specifically funded by bonds, have been delayed.
Right.
And I think that's really the same approach that we're using here. Vice Mayor.
I just wanted to point out an irony when we're talking about bricks and mortar. A number of our nonprofits have cooking facilities that they are going to have to upgrade their hoods to meet code, which they've been aware of for years, but we've been kind of lax, and now we've set a deadline. They all have to do it, and there's going to be a considerable outlay for all these nonprofits to bring their hoods up to standard. And some of them were requesting money that would have applied to that. So something we're imposing on them legitimately, and they've known about it, but it's all coming due, and they're going to have a considerable outlay for all these new hoods on their stoves to bring them up to code. So it's just kind of an irony when you talk about bricks and mortar on that one.
Councilmember Higgins.
Just a question about the bricks and mortar section. With the NSP funds, those are specific for the for individual housing.
Oh.
Is that true? So they can't be used for like
multifamily. Yeah, there's multifamily houses also as part of that project.
Can any of that be used for like, I'm just going to throw something out there, you know, the East Valley adults resource home?
It's not in foreclosure.
Yeah, the big criteria that it has to be in foreclosure. Yeah. And that would be the number one criteria.
Because they're not in foreclosure, they're renovating the existing building.
So there are more things than just the income level.
Right. Well, recall last year we did get additional stimulus dollars under CDBG for capital. And well, we chose to use it for capital because it was one-time dollar. And we funded the kitchen at the men's shelter. So we have used, when we've seen, you know, large dollars come in for kind of a one-time purpose, we chose last year and for the New Leaf men's shelter kitchen. Correct? Am I saying it right?
It's the kitchen and the basic needs building.
Yeah. So we've done that. You know, if dollars were to come again, and again, Carolyn's given us the number that she gets from the regional representative here for CBG. You know, would there be additional dollars in the future? Maybe those. That's how we'd like to use those, certainly as one-time expenditures. And something like the senior services kitchen area, would that be that'd be a project that would make a lot of sense to use that for?
Okay. Councilman Richens?
I just wanted to revisit my example with accessible space is the kind of project we should be holding up. You have a nonprofit coming in to do a project. We're going to give them $600,000. They're bringing $2.6 million in other sources to the table to do that project. That's kind of exactly what we're trying to get at. Good project.
But
now, are all the applications that were submitted, are they all included here?
Yes, mm-hmm. They are.
Okay. We'll talk later.
Okay. Have we answered everyone's general question? We got it. Okay. Thank you. I know we spent a lot more time. You can imagine if we would have gone down line item by line. So I think we've sort of set the stage. Thank you for explaining the process you went through, the philosophy is. And as Councilmember Summers whispered in my ear, a lot of these things are the implementation of items that council has specifically asked for over the last years. Points of emphasis and objectives that we have stated over the year as far as economic development and, you know, focusing on, when we say the downtown, it's the inner city, the central core type areas, because those are the areas that we think that if we get change, we can get the biggest bang for the buck. And it's not some feel-good, fuzzy thing. It's literally if we can be successful in turning around some of these things and stopping blight, that we get as a city and as a community a great return on that investment. And so I think staff's done a great job of at least trying to figure out some of the instructions and direction we gave them. So thank you. Okay. So what I would say is, once again, to repeat, if you have specific items that you have real heartburn with or you have some other things, please talk to Mr. Brady, and in a week or 2 weeks or whenever the time is, Mr. Brady will.
Well, let's get some of the council want to absorb, but get to us maybe in the next week, and then maybe we'll come back as soon
come
as
back
I kind of get everybody to council talk to them. We can come right back again and
okay.
Do it. But we'll still be going through the public hearing process, but right. We always do that. Our goal is here to get council ready before the 19th of
okay.
April.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Next item on the agenda is to hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the wastewater utility capital improvement program. Ms. Sorensen. And thank you. This is you got pushed off our last agenda, so thanks
motion
for coming back.
And Mayor, as Catherine gets comfortable in her seat, let me just remind the council what we're going through and be real clear about the process we're going through with these presentations. We've had the presentation on water resources, the water side of the business. Now you're having the wastewater today. The gas and electric side should be coming, I think we said next week, Brian. I think we're going to be ready, Jack, right next week. And so that does two things. One, it is just one getting council back to kind of a status and update of where we are with all these enterprise funds. talking about their issues. But really, we are, as they are utilities, they're very capital intensive. We are talking about and presenting to council, as you'll notice through these presentations, their capital needs that they will have over the next 4 to 5 years. Very clear, these are enterprise activities. They do not rely upon or not funded by the property tax, the secondary property tax, nor by sales tax. They are funded from the users of their activities, whether it's water, wastewater, gas, and electric. So the revenue bonds are used to fund those capital projects into the future, which is by far one of their largest expenditures annually. As you'll see in these schedules, as we start talking about updating the council on the proposed rates for this coming year and into the future, you'll see by and far, almost extensively, the rate increases that you'll see in the future are being driven by that debt service schedules, which are the amounts that are being used to pay off previous debt and looking forward to new debt. The good news is that as we've been able to go through these programs and really look at where we are, we're seeing both savings in existing projects, as well as we're making some decisions to push out a lot of the growth-related projects that we had anticipated maybe a couple of years ago, expecting, you know, having to try to keep up with growth and provide those services. We're now to push those out a little bit further. If you recall, when a couple weeks ago when Catherine was here talking about water, we talked about the treatment plant and that $100 million plus facility that was scheduled previously to come on in the next couple years or at least begin the construction. We've pushed that out a little bit further because we're seeing the slowing in growth. That will have an impact in a positive way of keeping our anticipated rates for our utilities down for the next couple years. So we'll realize the savings by pushing out some of the growth projects out into the future, as well as the savings that we're realizing with the current projects that we're doing. So there's some, and we'll go through that. The council will start, first we'll go to the Audit and Finance Committee with the proposed new rates for the utilities April 1st, Brian? April 1st, and so you'll begin to see that. But I also want to be clear is that you're going to be seeing, so this is kind of looking prospectively out into the future with a new authorization. But you will also begin to see, we'll be bringing to council fairly quickly, the sale of bonds related to the utilities. But these are bonds that were already authorized by previous actions of a vote back in 2000. When was that utility vote? 2006? Six.
And before.
That you'll begin seeing, we'll be bringing that to council because we need to continue to, the current program needs to be funded. It's been authorized, but we need to sell those bonds going forward. So there's a lot of moving parts here, and we're overlapping a lot of things that happen this time of year. This is looking today, we're again looking prospectively out into the future, looking out to the beyond the current authorization of bond funds, which we believe will have expended the majority of those by the end of this next authorization, so the end of next year. So we're going to be looking towards sometime in the fall, a need to come back for additional authorization. This is scheduled. This is planned. We talked about doing this in 2-year period of time. The good news is it looks, as we move forward with these plans, the request that we're going to come to council with is going to be less than we had anticipated, again, because of savings that we're realizing in the current construction market, as well as the fact that we're pushing more activities out into the future related to growth. So what that leaves us with is continuing to invest in the infrastructure that's been in place for the last 30, 40, 50 years that is in need of replacement. These are one of those enterprises we don't have a lot of discretion about whether or not to do a capital project. If the water line breaks, we have to fix it. If the wastewater line breaks, which is even it's less pleasant, we have to fix it. What we're trying to do is come up with a plan, and Catherine and her team have done a really good job, and I know I'm stealing a lot of their thunder, but of really strategically trying to identify, and you've seen that when we did water, where the older pipes are, where the problematic pipes are, where the needs are in the system, and try to get ahead of those. So instead of doing them on a crisis basis, we're doing them proactively going forward. But the good news is we're stretching out the program. We're going to realize some savings from the rates that we've talked about in the past for our ratepayers, yet we still will be able to deliver a pretty robust capital program that will allow us to continue to reinvest in Mesa. This is really a reinvestment plan back into Mesa, where we've had infrastructure that's been there for 40 or 50 years. Now we need to go back and replace it, or put in, replace the older facilities that address the infrastructure. But again, none of this impacts our secondary property tax calculations. This is all rate-based, and we'll be bringing those rates to the Audit and Finance Committee here in a week or so, and then to the rest of the council shortly thereafter.
Okay, thank you. And Councilmember Summers has a question.
Thank you, Mayor. As you go through this presentation, I have concerns about some of the statements that were made from an East Mesa perspective. And if you could address those in the presentation, that would be fine. One issue is in using the water treatment plant on Signal Butte and Elliott as an example. We're going to have to construct this at some point. So what I'm concerned about is maybe that we're saving a little money now to spend more later. We are realizing some fairly significant savings in construction costs because of the current economy, anywhere from 30 to, in some cases, 60%. So by not pursuing projects like that, are we going to end up paying more in the future? Another issue is, what is our capacity for water in attracting jobs and economic development? If we, to be competitive, we have to have infrastructure, water, roads, sewer lines. Otherwise, we can't attract the jobs down in that area, and we have a vision for 100,000 high-wage jobs. So in the short term or even middle term, how is not constructing some of that growth capacity in the gateway area going to impact our ability to bring in economic development? And finally, there are some secondary projects that are dependent upon completion of your projects. That is, street projects are waiting for water lines to be laid down. Otherwise, we're constructing streets this year, next year ripping up the streets in order to put pipes in it, and then doing streets again. And if there's anything that's going to make people angry, it's doing that kind of work. So how is the plan that you have for the 2010 revenue bonds going to fit into that in some of those projects? So with that, I'll wait to see how this works out within the context of the presentation. Thank
Great.
You.
Okay. Okay.
Catherine, you want to
good
introduce
morning.
You?
Yeah, good morning, Mayor. Councilmember.
Introduce your team over there.
Yes, thank you. You guys met Jake West a couple weeks ago. He is our assistant director in charge of collections and distribution. With me is Richard Bradford. He's our assistant director over the wastewater program. And to his left is Ronnie Lopez, our wastewater treatment plant superintendent. And you guys are familiar with the format of this presentation, so I'll try to whip through it, but of course, stop me if you have questions. So what we do here in the wastewater program, the reclaimed water program, is of course we respond to our customers' needs. We collect the wastewater and deliver it to treatment plants. Along the way, as we do that, we ensure that the quality of the wastewater does not harm the collection system or the treatment plants. We process that wastewater into reclaimed water, and then we deliver that reclaimed water, hopefully for beneficial use. A brief overview of the system: 4 wastewater plants, 17 lift stations, diversion structures, sulfide control stations, and 1,700 miles of pipe. So it is, like the water system, a very large system, and we estimate its replacement value at about $2.5 billion. You can read for yourself some of the ways we think we fit into some of your strategic objectives and initiatives. I just wanted to point out, though, one of our central issues that we'll be dealing with now and in the future is reclaimed water. And I think that goes along with quality of life and sustainability, and you'll be hearing more about that. So you saw this slide at our last presentation. This is what the Water Resources Department does, everything from bringing the water in, the raw water into the plants, delivering it to the customers, collecting it back from the customers, treating it, and delivering it for reclaimed beneficial use. Today, obviously, we're going to be focusing on the wastewater side of that. Let me start first with how we respond to customers' needs. This is far less pleasant on the wastewater side than it is on the water side, as you can imagine. But we have about 116,000 accounts.
People obviously have concerns with blockage, overflows. We respond to complaints about roaches and odors, and then whatever other problems might occur in the wastewater system. We also collect wastewater and deliver it to the plants. The aspects of collecting wastewater include, obviously, the wastewater lines, manholes, which give you access to the lines, diversion structures, which just move the wastewater where it needs to go, so we can use those to move wastewater to one treatment plant or another. And then, of course, lift stations, which we use when gravity does not work to our benefit.
Mayor?
Councilman Higgins.
I was going to ask you, I don't understand, how does that work? How does a lift station work? Is it like a pressure pump, or I mean, what is the actual, I mean, I don't get that.
Yeah, it's a pressure pump that if a gravity line, we end up with a gravity line and we have to go into another line that's at a higher level, we vertically lift the wastewater pump and put it into the next
gravity line. So it's actually like a elevator, like a lift, or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a pump that's got what we call a force main, and that's a pressure line that goes to the next gravity line.
It's just in line? That's, you know,
yeah, we have 17 lift stations that throughout the system, wherever we can't gravity, then we pick it up and move it into the next gravity system.
How do you power that?
Electrically. Yeah.
A lot of hamsters.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So in terms of wastewater lines, 1,700 miles of it, we, just as on the water side, we try to target the worst areas, and a lot of thought goes into, okay, what's the worst area? And hopefully, Councilmember Summers answers some of your questions, but we try very hard to coordinate these projects with transportation so that, like you said, people, you know, we don't have situations where a road is just finished and then a year later we're going in and digging it up. But we also try to coordinate with the water program and with gas. And in terms of wastewater lines, we really focus on the larger lines because failure of the large lines can be, as you can imagine, pretty catastrophic and extraordinarily unpleasant. There's a very small number of large lines in the system, but they tend to be the most important. We're focusing our current efforts on the baseline and southern sewers that are, they're very large, they're both over 30 inches, and they're relatively old, they're 30 years old.
And where do those lines generally end up, baseline and southern? Variety, do they end up at 91st Avenue?
Yes, thank you, Mayor. They do. They travel all the way through Tempe and then through Phoenix and make their way all the way to 91st Avenue eventually.
And when you say they're very large, how big is, for example, what's baseline southern? Those are 48, 60, 74?
Baseline is 60-inch, and then there's an older 33-inch. So there's two lines in there. Mm-hmm. Southern is in the 36-inch range.
Okay, but you have a 60, that's 5 feet. You have a 5 foot in diameter line
going down baseline road
that is pretty much full of stuff.
Right. Yes, exactly. And as it makes its way into other jurisdictions, that line is co-owned with those jurisdictions.
Yeah, I developed a property down on baseline in Phoenix that was a continuation. It was, I think, either 84 or 96 inches. It was a wastewater line that was literally eight feet in diameter.
Right.
Actually,
huge.
Catherine hasn't corrected us yet.
Oh.
We don't have wastewater anymore.
Oh, yes.
We've declared an end to
it's
wastewater.
It's not waste. It's
an opportunity for reclamation.
Yes.
It's like cars. We don't have used cars. We have gently used cars.
Yes, something
this
like that.
This is gently used water, pre-owned water.
Pre-owned
water.
Yeah. Yes.
We don't have wastewater. We have pre-owned water. There
you can imagine the analogies in this industry are difficult. But anyway.
But, I mean, you bring up an interesting point. Like you said, I think your last one, this used to be like wastewater. It used to be water that we wanted to dispose of.
Right.
Now this is a valuable asset that needs to be treated accordingly.
Absolutely. And we'll talk a little bit about that.
Okay.
Another big issue, and I'm going to let Dick talk a little bit about this. We do have significant areas in the city of Mesa that are not on our sewer system. They are still on septic. Dick, you want to talk about
that? Yeah. Overall, as it says on the slide, we have approximately 11 square miles of within our planning area, which includes all the way out to Meridian Road, and the outline of the slide shows what our active management plan area is for the whole sewer system. A large portion of it in East Mesa is in the county area. There's a portion that's in Arizona Water Company also that but we're charged by the state that's part of our management area. Within this area, there's approximately 29,000 or 24,000 parcels in this area, and within Mesa, there's about 4,800 parcels, which most of them are single-family lots.
I'm sorry. Okay. Obviously, our goal is at some point not to have septic in our boundaries, and that's it's a very difficult goal to achieve. Right. We are working on developing a plan. Dick's been taking the lead on that. It's difficult. It's a complicated situation. It's something that as we look into and do a little bit more research into, we'd like to take back to TIC at some future point with some ideas of how we'll begin taking a bite out of this elephant. In the meantime, we do coordinate with the county. When these parcels are in the county, it's the county that has to give approval for putting in a septic or repairing a septic system. And we do coordinate with them. And where it's possible for us per code to have these citizens plug into the sewer system instead of replace their septic, we do try to enforce that.
Mm-hmm. Councilman Sunder, Summers.
There are several issues involved with that because I have a few of these areas, and they're older communities. They tend to be low mod communities too, many of them, not all, but many of them. So affordability is one issue. Also, the way the rules are set up seems to be odd. If they're within a certain distance of the city sewer system, then they have to hook in. What's that distance?
Approximately 200 feet.
200 feet, and then they have to pay the full cost of that?
Yeah, if it's within 200 feet, they pay the full cost. If it's beyond 200 feet or costs more than $6,000, then they're granted a waiver to renew their septic tank.
But $6,000 is pretty...
It's very low.
It's a very low amount, so really... Yeah. The way the rules are set up, nobody has to hook in unless that sewer system comes right in front of the house.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we almost have to, if we're going to compel, in a way, folks to hook up when they're done, we almost have to run these lines in front of the homes so that, one, it's affordable, and two, it's well within that 200 feet.
Right.
Are we making any plans to try to lay new sewers in?
We are, and that's part of the plan that we're trying to develop, and we're just in the beginning process of developing that plan, but we are looking at the possibility of maybe there's some areas where if we extend sewer lines at the city's cost a certain distance, then we might get enough septic systems that are now within that 200 feet that you could get a reasonable return on investment in terms of the fees to buy into the sewer system and then the monthly rates, you know, that you would get from these customers. Now, we don't know yet. We haven't done that analysis, but we are looking at that as hopefully a creative solution. There's also special improvement districts. We talked about that with some of our communities in your area. And we're also looking at the possibility of, are there some grants out there, maybe leverage some other funding. So there's a lot to this. It's a very complicated issue. And again, we hope to bring a more thought out plan to you guys in the near future.
The thing with this too is so that we're running out of time in a way, because the septic systems that are there are approaching the end of their usable life. So once they fail and they have to be replaced, these are what, 30 years, 20 to 40 years. So once they start to fail and they're all reaching that age, if they're replaced by new septic systems, then it's going to be another 20, 30, 40 years before we have the opportunity again. So
absolutely,
in a way, now is the time to try to address this issue so that we can get more people hooked up. Otherwise, it's going to be another quite a bit of time.
Absolutely. We're with you on that, and that's why we're trying to develop a reasonable plan.
Okay, thank you.
Councilmember Higgins?
And why do we want to get rid of the people that are on septic system right now? I mean,
no,
what?
This is septic tank. Don't get rid of people.
Yeah. We want to keep the people.
We like the people. It's a public health issue. I mean, as you can imagine, when you have septic systems, they discharge those wastes into the ground and into the aquifer. And it's better for public health and safety if it's treated.
But I mean,
treated. There's
many parts of the country where, I mean, that's still the standard. So. Do we have special needs in Arizona?
When we say it's a standard, it's not the desirable. It's
right.
Just that when you have a rural area or whatever, it's just not economically feasible, or whatever reason to run
in
a sewer
urban
system.
Area, it's not necessarily the best situation.
Well, it's not, because you have 27,000 septic tanks. How many of those are truly functioning? That's the thing. We're assuming that these septic tanks are doing their job, and most of them, or a lot of them, don't.
Right.
Not most of them. A lot of them don't. I don't know what it is.
It is.
Catherine, they're coming to us, too. It's not something we're necessarily just, I mean, we want to do it, but also they're looking towards it, and as their septic tanks begin to fall.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, a good case in point is we went to a neighborhood meeting in Councilmember Summers' district over by the Arizona Golf Club, right? It's called
Golf Resort.
And they have a very old septic system, and oddly enough, the septics that were built for them are very, very small, because it was contemplated as a retirement community, and they thought one, maybe two people living in this house. One of the complaints that residents there had was, you know, they have company over for the holidays or whatever, and not good, you know. So, yeah, we do have people who are not happy with septic who are coming to us, and we're trying to extend what resources we can to them. Obviously, we have to be careful with that as well. So that's why we need to carefully balance what the city pays for, what individuals have to pay
and
for.
And the county and the state are also very aggressively trying to phase out septic in urban areas. Yeah. So a lot of this isn't even our initiative. It's either the neighbors or the residents. But also the county is real stingy on giving septic extensions and news.
Absolutely.
And if you have a septic system like in a trailer park, they flat out won't do it. If you have a leach field or whatever, they won't. You get hit that 30 years and they flat out won't renew it. Mm-hmm. I've dealt with that on a couple, three situations where especially trailer parks, generally those leach fields have reached their capacity, they've reached their obsolescence, and the county just comes in and says, you will tie into the city sewer, even if it's greater than, because of the public health problem.
So are we going to, do we look at that? I mean, annexation cases, we haven't had a lot of them lately, mm-hmm. but why don't we add that to our annexation issue, like if you want to annex, not only, you know, you have to be able to hook up to the sewer system.
Yeah, we could take a look at that. You know, obviously if someone has a functioning septic system and they're happy with it, that I presume might be a point of contention for them.
I would
tell
you that in development, one of our development standards, if someone wants to annex and develop in our, we don't allow that.
Yeah, no, I think the councilwoman, a good point. I think that is something we need to look at.
No, it is for
existence. Definitely, especially if we have the lines already, because we have lines out there in those unincorporated areas, definitely. I think
but just so you know, if you want to develop, if you're in the county and you have undeveloped property and you don't want to do any development, I think our standard does require that you hook into a sewer.
Yeah.
I know that because we've had projects have to run sewer lines a mile, otherwise they don't develop.
Right.
But that's the first thing they come to tick for a waiver.
Yeah, and that's just something we have to
I mean, this is
right.
a good point.
It is.
You remember those meetings.
Again, you know, and we bring it up here because it is a big issue, and we are looking to include some money in future authorization so that we can start, you know, taking a bite out of this elephant. So you'll see a little bit more about that.
Okay, well, good. We beat this one to death. Let's move on.
Okay.
But it was fun.
All right. So manholes, we have a lot of them, as you can imagine. And here again, we focus on the ones that are on the larger lines, more critical. Our plan is to try to rehabilitate 70 per year, and those are the ones on the large lines. We've also implemented a new program, actually across the board in the entire department, but a new program for inspection and condition assessment as part of our asset management program. Diversion structures, there's about 31 of them. They are, as I said, used to move water around the system, used to move wastewater around the system, and they have a life expectancy of about 10 to 15 years. Lift stations, I think we covered that. So I'm going to move on to ensuring the quality of wastewater. We have to make sure that it doesn't harm the pipes and that it doesn't harm the treatment plants. To do this, we use sulfide control stations, which control both odor and corrosion. We did receive a stimulus money for rehabilitation of two of our old ones, one on Alma School and Horn, that's right. So, but we have quite a few of those in the system as well. Then we also have an industrial pretreatment program. This is really important, especially for the health of the plants. Ronnie can attest to that. It is part of our health and sanitation section of the city code. We have staff that go out and regularly inspect industrial facilities to make sure that they're not putting anything down in the sewer system that would be harmful to the pipes or to the bugs in the plants. And we also have regular inspections of basically all commercial facilities, restaurants, dry cleaners, medical facilities, others. Obviously, the one of our big areas of focus is grease, because grease tends to clog the system. But there's other things that can get down there, pesticides, organic chemicals, other things that are also of concern. So we also obviously process this wastewater into a beneficial resource, into reclaimed water. We do that obviously to protect public health and to protect the environment. We do that at our reclaimed water plants. We have four of them, the Northwest, the Southeast, the Greenfield, and the 91st Avenue. The Northwest plant, maybe you guys don't know this, but the Northwest plant is the site of the original City of Mesa septic tank back in the days when we were on septic ourselves. I think it goes back, construction goes back all the way to 1948. We have had major upgrades to this plant in 1990 and again in 2002. Its current capacity is 18 million gallons a day. We don't anticipate expanding this plant further. We think it's where it needs to be for build out. Of note, it does accept wastewater from the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian community from the Pima Road corridor. This map shows you kind of the area of Mesa, and I'm sorry I left off the Pima community, but it shows you kind of what areas of Mesa flow into the Northwest plant. One of the issues that we have at the Northwest plant is that someone built a lake in the middle of the river downstream of us. And because of that, there are some pretty serious water quality concerns. And that creates problems for us in terms of some of our compliance issues. As you can imagine, you know, regulatory compliance only becomes stricter. It never becomes less strict. And phosphorus and other contaminants are an issue for us in terms of discharging from this plant into the Salt River. When the Granite Reef Underground Storage Project, which is a recharge project that we own 25% of, when that's open, we send all of our flows from the Northwest plant to that recharge project. And when we do so, we receive what's called a long-term storage credit, which then becomes part of our assured water supply portfolio. We can take that credit and pump it out of a well anywhere within our service area. So those are very valuable to us. The GRUSP facility is located on Pima lands, and it's part of the deal that we worked out with the Pima community some years ago. We accept their wastewater from the Pima corridor. They provide us a place to do recharge. However, we are having issues with this facility. When we built the facility, drought conditions. The river was almost always dry. Mounding was not a problem, but more and more we see that mounding of groundwater is a problem in the area. And eventually, we think it's very likely we're going to need to approach the Pima community about finding an alternative solution.
Define mounding.
Oh, I'm sorry. When the groundwater table just gets too close to the surface.
It doesn't perk.
When we try to recharge, enough. It doesn't go in.
It's like having
in.
A traffic jam of water, basically.
Exactly. Right. Thank you. Yeah.
Okay.
Good enough. That was a good analogy.
Yeah, Dan Clevenger's been going, yeah, traffic.
Yeah.
Sorry. We'll Mr. Clevenger up. Talk about cars. He gets excited.
Should we narrow the river there? Yeah. It's the cleanest analogy I've ever heard. The Southeast plant, I want to point out that this is actually Ronnie Lopez standing next to this facility in what? This must have been about 1988 or so?
This is like 21 years ago.
Yeah, we tried to convince him to grow the beard or the mustache again, but he wouldn't do it. The Southeast plant is Mesa owned and operated, 8 million gallons a day capacity. Construction began in the late 80s. It was purchased from Turner, what used to be the Turner Ranch's wastewater sanitation. I can't remember what it was called. And it also went through major upgrades in 2000 and 2007. And here again, we do not anticipate expanding the capacity of this plant.
Quick question. Councilmember Fenter has a question.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mayor. Are we still doing reclaimed water into RWCD from this plant?
No, we no longer are. All the reclaimed water from this plant either is delivered down to the Gila River Indian Community or to Superstition Springs Golf Course, for irrigation, or when those two options are not available to us, we can send it to 91st Avenue, or we can discharge into the East Maricopa Floodway. But we do not discharge into the RWCD canals anymore. That was part of our last settlement agreement with RWCD. Yeah. So here again, we also have some life cycle replacement costs, as you can imagine. The third plant that we operate is the Greenfield Water Reclamation Plant. This is a joint venture with the town of Gilbert and the town of Queen Creek. It was completed in 2007, so it's a relatively young plant. Its total capacity is 16 MGD, but we only have about 4 of that. It discharges also into the East Maricopa.
Yeah, Councilman Richens has a question.
Yes.
I've been looking at your last three maps.
Yes.
Go back two maps. There's
yeah.
an area there, the blue area in the middle of the Northwest Water Treatment Plant area, that isn't covered by anything on any of your maps.
Oh.
About Stapley and Gilbert.
Yeah.
That explains a lot.
It does. I'm sorry that I'm not sure. Let me look through.
Yeah. That's a glitch in our map. That actually, the way the plumbing is, it goes down to the Southern Avenue sewer line and goes to 91st Avenue.
Yeah.
So it should be included on the drainage area of flow that goes to 91st Avenue. Just the
yeah, I think we omitted a map plumbed. For that, though.
Yeah.
It's included, but as the gravity pulls it down, then it goes into one of our interceptors, which takes it west over to the plant. So you've got a little gap there, maybe on the map, because there might not be a lot of infrastructure, but that's kind of where following the terrain of the land and then going west over the
place. That's not a place that we have a bunch of septic tanks.
No.
It's getting it's going somewhere.
Yeah.
No.
Thank you. Yes, I'm glad you pointed that out. I don't think we have
it's
a map.
It's one place its initial treatment is 91st Avenue. Right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And
whereas most of the other area you have initial treatment, or a lot of the remaining city, 91st Avenue is an alternative or a secondary or whatever, whereas this stuff just completely goes straight.
That little section of Central Mesa does go to 91st Avenue. Where
okay.
Around Southern and Baseline, it all goes to 91st. Down,
right.
down the Dobson Ranch area.
And I'm sorry, I think we omitted a map that shows the 91st Avenue drainage basin.
Did.
So I'm sorry about that.
We'll schedule another meeting. You can come back and show us that map.
Yeah, I'm sure we'd all love to do that. So, again, the water from the Greenfield plant, we deliver it mainly to the Gila River Indian community as part of our exchange. As you recall, we then get CAP water back. It's another way that reclaimed water is a very important part of our assured water supply. When we cannot deliver to the Gila River Indian community, this water also goes into the Gilbert reuse system, and it can be discharged into the East Maricopa floodway. Now, this one, we do expect to expand. We expect that future expansions for wastewater treatment will occur at this plant only. And we're hoping to expand this plant in the year 2018, and that ultimately Mesa would have a capacity here of about 28 million gallons a day. 91st Avenue is a joint venture with Phoenix, Tempe, Scottsdale, and Glendale. Construction started in 1965. And it is a very large plant, 205 million gallons a day. Our capacity is 30. We currently only use about 19 of that. And as you can imagine, there's a lot of life cycle replacement issues with this plant. So the last thing that we do is we take the reclaimed water and we deliver it for beneficial use. You saw this slide last time. It got a little squished in this presentation, but it was, again, just to illustrate that it's an important part of our supply, and it's also a lot of our contingency for the future. However, I want to point out
I didn't get a chance to ask last time, but
sure.
You have the dip and then the bump.
Yeah, I know.
What's
that's a little
about?
Odd. That's when the space behind Roosevelt Dam fills. It tends to come in very large chunks. Right now, it's very full. So we have access to, sitting here today, we have access to 40,000 acre-feet of water behind that dam that's ours to use as we please. But but then as we use it, it draws back down again. So that's why it looks.
The dam had a certain
right,
level,
right.
And then we help fund the additional capacity. When we get to that additional elevation, our benefit is significant, and it rises our resources available.
So that's more of a reflection of actual, whereas the other trend line is projected.
Right. What I do then is just try to smooth it out for.
It all flowing down.
We assume we assume it'll come to us at about 10,000 acre feet a year, you know, on average.
Well, Councilmember Summers made a comment about all the water that's being discharged right now. Could you cover that real quickly as to why that isn't all wasted? Or I'm assuming it's not all wasted.
Sure. Well, yeah. The storage on the Salt and Verde River systems is very small compared to other rivers, compared to the Colorado River, for example. So there's just a limit on what can be stored there. I think it's about 1 million acre feet is all. So if anything above that comes down the river, we just can't hold it in the dams. It goes downstream, and in a year like this, they are projecting that it will actually reach the Colorado River, that it will join with the Gila and reach the Colorado River. And I think that the Bureau of Reclamation has plans to divert that water to Mexico and then save some water in Lake Mead on the Colorado system so that, because the Colorado system is still kind of in drought status. So it kind of saves some water in Lake Mead. So it will be used, it will benefit us, but we can't really use it directly. It goes down the road.
Right, so we trade credits. I mean, if we can deliver water to Mexico, we have certain responsibilities from the Colorado to deliver certain acre
treaty
feet.
Treaty obligations.
1.5 million acre
and
feet
if we
a year,
can,
right?
If we can satisfy that through runoff from the salt down the Gila into the Colorado, that means they don't have to discharge that, use the Colorado for that. So it does benefit us in the sense that basically we don't use water in Lake Mead, which
exactly.
Eventually will come into the CAP canal, so forth and so on.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, and I'm sorry, I did want to point out on this slide that making beneficial use of reclaimed water is a very complicated, difficult, and expensive undertaking, unfortunately. So our current options for making beneficial use of this water is, again, we can discharge from the Northwest plant to GRUSP for long-term storage credits when GRUSP is open. We can deliver to the Gila River Indian Community in exchange for CAP water. We do deliver to the Palo Verde Nuclear Power Plant and receive money for those deliveries. And we also do have a limited purple pipe system along the 202 freeway and at the Northwest plant itself for landscaping. But we are looking at...
Excuse me.
Yes.
Landscaping at the Northwest plant? Could you please point out where the landscaping is at the Northwest plant?
Well, for what will be.
The plant.
What will someday be.
Yeah, I know. That's
really... As I like to say...
Thank you, Kevin. Or I got it. It is as much as it's landscaping for Northwest Pleasant, and I really don't want to focus on that. It's really landscaping for the major entrance into Mesa. It is our significant. So what
that was the point we were making.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the point is,
right now, if we're using it, we're watering bare ground and rocks.
The rocks are growing very well.
They are.
Yes, they are. They do well in this.
And our goal is though to come up with use some a reclaimed water system to start putting that in place. Then at some point, then we could look at possibly putting some phasing in some kind of landscaping in the future.
Councilmember Kavanaugh, welcome back, by the way.
Thank you, Ed. And that issue was obviously a major issue when that plant was reconstructed, and the council originally did have plans for significant landscaping and screening and public art and you name it, but there were some reversals in council policy and personnel that led to that, having no landscaping, no public art, no entryway into the city. But so it was, those of you long-timers know that
I think it would be great if we pulled maybe some of those plans off the shelf or maybe revised them and at a future date at least brought us back.
That's our plan.
Brought us some sort of plan because I think it is the plan itself, you know, is obviously a stunning structure. Whether you like it or not, it's there. You know it. But it is definitely an eyesore and it's inconsistent with what we require of others. So I would love it if you would.
We've been working on something. Okay. We're going to be bringing something to the council.
Yeah, we will be bringing something forward.
Okay, thank you.
Epcot Center, Mini.
Yeah, I thought it was a golf ball.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. Back on.
All right. So,
2 hours is our limit.
But as I said, making beneficial use of reclaimed water is very expensive and difficult, and it, frankly, it often just doesn't work that well. And we need redundancy here because it is part of our future supply. So staff is currently working on some new plans for how we're going to ensure that we're always able to make beneficial use of the reclaimed water. We're talking with the Gila River Indian Community about additional storage on their lands for for times, because right now they take that water for agriculture, but there are times because of weather or infrastructure outages or other conditions on the reservation where they can't accept those flows. We want to make sure they have some redundancy there to always accept those flows. We would like very much to talk with the Maricopa Pima community about an alternative to grass. That could be direct reuse. They have a fair amount of agriculture, or that could be some other recharge facility. We are also looking at the possibility of building some additional purple pipes here in the city. A lot of our opportunity to do that and have developers pay for it has passed us, but not all. And so we're going to be taking a renewed look at that as well. And there is a possibility, too, that we could partner with, say, the town of Queen Creek and do some recharge in Queen Creek Wash. Last, you could always use some of this reclaimed water for just, you know, recreational amenities, some riparian habitat or other types of facilities. So we will be coming back at some point with a plan that we've developed that will present these alternatives and some of the costs and benefits associated with that.
And just quickly, Mayor and Council, as Catherine pointed out, this reclaimed water is not easy. It's somewhat difficult. But I would suggest to Council finding new water resources as equally, if not more difficult, to find and to logistically bring to the city. So we're going to try to deal with what we have and see if we can find better reuse opportunities in the future.
Exactly. Well, the reality is, I mean, I think you presented this previously. Well, at least I watched the advertisements. Our water use in the city is, what's the percentage on outdoor use versus indoor use? It's
probably around half.
Is it half total?
Yeah.
Now, I know that, you know, each individual house, we're not going to get to that point.
Right.
Although in some communities, master plan, we could, and it's something that I'd like to look at, for example, certainly in the Mesa Proving Ground and the Gateway area, we should be planning for that simply because I think at some point in time the need's going to be there, as along with water harvesting and other types of water conservation, because that's the area that's most at risk. Because it's outside the system.
Absolutely.
And so we're completely relying on CAP allotments. Mm-hmm. I know, based on your last one, basically that's CAP allotments out there,
yes,
right?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Which is most at risk from all of our portfolio that we have.
It's the least secure. Absolutely. That's correct.
Least secure, most at risk. I think that's saying the same thing, but that's okay.
Yeah.
I like yours better. The fact is that we should be planning now, because that – we're getting original infrastructure going in there as it relates to water and wastewater. Mm-hmm. And along with the non-potable plan that we have there that pulls untreated water out for use in large landscape areas, we ought to have a redundant system for making use of recharge, or not recharge, but reclaimed water also in that
yes.
area.
Yes, oh, absolutely.
Okay.
So I'm going to move on to system funding. Obviously, as Chris said, the system is paid for by those who benefit from the system itself through customer rates and through revenue bonds. And I'll move into talking about our proposed 2010 bond authorization. Again, when we respond to customers' needs, that's not capital money, that's all O&M. So I'll move to collecting wastewater and delivering it to treatment plants. The map here shows you some of the projects that we're hoping will be included in a future bond authorization. Some lift stations and lines, and you'll notice the large green line at the bottom of the screen, which is baseline, and also some sulfide control stations. And Chris mentioned it earlier, but here you see it again. You'll see some zeros in some of the early years on some of these, and that's because we have had significant savings on current construction projects. But we'll spend a fair amount of money replacing aging wastewater lines. That is mainly those large lines in Southern and Baseline. And then here is where we put some money in to begin to address the septic areas and what we're going to do with that. $500,000 is an estimate that we think, you know, hopefully will at least get us started on starting to tackle this problem. Yeah.
Councilmember Summers?
What? $500,000 isn't a lot of money when it comes to putting in sewer lines. So is this a specific area that you're trying to concentrate on?
Councilmember Summers, our plan is not yet developed enough to concentrate on a specific area. But I will say that depending on the area, actually you could build some of these lines for that amount of money, depending on the area. Because you're not always talking about very long extensions. Sometimes you're talking about relatively short extensions that might really get you a lot of bang for your buck.
Okay, I'd be interested to see some follow-up on that.
And isn't the challenge, we may be able to build the lines, but it's getting the property owners who have to build the, service lines from the home
from the house,
into the public line. And that's ultimately, that's probably the biggest challenge for our program is to try to help. What can we do? Because we can't necessarily go spend our public dollars on private land, but how can we come up with programs, maybe revolving low fund or loans or some other program to help them so they can connect into our lines?
Okay, that makes sense.
Then we will spend some money rehabilitating some of our diversion structures and some of the aging lift stations. In terms of ensuring the quality of the wastewater, again, here you see a lot of zeros, which is great. And I'll remind you that we did receive some stimulus funding for rehabilitation of sulfide stations. So we don't anticipate having to spend a lot of money on that for the next few years. We will also spend a relatively small amount of money to buy some compliance lab equipment. What we're doing with that is we're trying to purchase this equipment and then phase out the use of third-party labs where we can get a return on investment on that machine. And so far, that's worked very well. We purchased one machine, and we hope to purchase another relatively soon. And we've changed the staffing in our lab so that we can accommodate more in-house and make use of existing labor rather than using outside labs. In terms of processing wastewater into reclaimed water, which is really the plants, this is the good news story, that the upgrades that have taken place have been relatively recent at the Northwest, the Southeast, and, of course, the Greenfield plant is relatively new. So we've already spent a fair amount of money getting those plants where they need to be. We don't anticipate needing to spend much more until we need to expand the Greenfield Water Reclamation Plant, which, again, we're hoping will be in 2018. So there's not much in this future authorization for plants.
You said a little earlier that the 91st Avenue treatment plant is going to have some ongoing costs. Is that embedded in, because of its age?
Right. It's embedded in our, and we pay for that through O&M as well.
Yeah, we don't, it's not a, we don't, because it's in
we
Phoenix,
don't bond it.
Right.
They just send us a bill for it. So it's, we can't bond for it. We have to just pay it through the operating costs.
But let me talk about that for just a minute. We are really focusing our efforts on how we can help Phoenix control some of its costs at 91st Avenue. And obviously it's something that they're interested in as well. So staff has really stepped up to the plate this last year to start really scrutinizing some of these expenses and questioning them and getting Phoenix on board with that, which is easy because it's hard times for everybody. So I am cautiously hopeful that we will be able to see maybe some decrease in expenses at 91st Avenue.
Well, and really, we're not talking about different programs here. It's just a matter of who's floating the bonds, because we float the bonds. They're paid for within the rate structure, and Phoenix float the bonds. It's still paid for within the rate structure. So it's just that whose name is the debt in?
Right. Is
really the only difference. As far as the payment source and even the mechanics, we either pay a check to our bondholders or we pay a check to the city of Phoenix and their bondholders. Really, it works out about the same. Is that accurate?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So then we do anticipate spending some money on reclaimed water infrastructure in this new authorization. Again, you know, it's difficult and fairly expensive to do this. Recharge facilities, for example, fairly expensive undertaking. Reuse, purple pipes, unfortunately, they're expensive. So we put some money in that we hope can be used to create some redundancy in our reclaimed water system as well. So in summary, our four-year capital needs, we estimate at about $87 million in life cycle replacements and in ensuring reliability for existing customers, which is about 4% of that system value that we talked about. However, we're fortunate in that because of the savings Chris talked about in current prices, we've still got $50 million in remaining authorization. So we're asking for a $37 million bond authorization, which in comparison to past authorizations is actually relatively small.
And then, Mayor and Council, what you'll see is that will reflect, you'll start seeing the reflection of that savings and our ability to extend the program
back from 2006. Further, you'll see the savings in the rates that we'll be bringing to the council. So,
and I'm going to ask something really strange here, because I've been in a bond cutting mode since I came on this council, but I want to make sure that we're covered for when this economy does recover, and that we make sure we have sufficient capacity to handle additional lines in Southeast Mesa, things like that. So, I mean, I like the carryover. I like the 37, but I want to make sure that within that 37 that we have sufficient capacity to handle what might be a need if we need to throw in a water line, not a water line, but a sewer line in Southeast Mesa. Right. Because somebody wants to build a huge plant there, and development happened earlier than we thought it would.
Absolutely, Mayor and Council.
And so if you need to round that up to take care of additional capacity.
We could do it that way. What we thought as we talked this through, because we went through a lot of discussions about how much growth-related improvement should we put in here, we chose to push some of those further out into the future. But here, remember, you're looking at a four-year plan.
Yeah,
we did a two-year plan before. What we look at is we start seeing a lot of activity, we would then suggest to the council, and then this four-year doesn't look like it'd be enough, we could come back in 2 years and do another authorization and pick up those additional costs. That's how we'd see how to do it.
Yeah, I don't know that we get a lot of bang for our buck, whether it's $37 or $38 million.
Oh, that. Yeah, we could.
But if you're $1 million short and you have a right in your knee, all of a sudden, you know, that's what I'm talking about.
Okay, okay.
You know,
sure.
I wouldn't quibble over one or two minutes of authorization. We're not approving projects. We're just having authorization here. And since these are revenue, that means if we do have a need, it's going to be because there's somebody that's going to use that,
correct,
which means it's going to pay for itself.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And they would.
So I don't have this is much different than the approach we take with general obligation bonds,
fair,
where we create, in many cases, our own demand, whereas this, the customers basically create the demand.
And we don't have to sell the bonds if they're not needed. We can always go, even outside a four-year plan, we could sell them in the fifth year still.
Yeah.
And they'd be eligible.
Yeah, I just want to make sure we don't carve it so much that we have a. You know, Councilmember Summers and I are dealing with an issue right now with a major user out in Southeast Mesa that he has two or three sites that they're looking at. One of the sites has no infrastructure there. It's planned to have infrastructure, but we didn't anticipate this use coming this early.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to make sure we have capacity within our program that if some major employer shows up and uses a piece of land earlier than we anticipated, that we can go in there and provide services don't lose that opportunity.
Let's go back and we can address that. It wouldn't be significant, but we can add some additional dollars.
No,
that's fine.
Actually, on the wastewater side, the infrastructure in Southeast Mesa is pretty good.
Yeah. This is just a general statement because I was going to make it when we were talking about water also. It goes to all of our revenue type utility.
The existing authorization is already picking up some of the areas.
Okay, good. I just want to make sure.
We'll look at it again, make sure we're not short. We wouldn't be short of that.
All right.
So between the two programs, we're looking at $37 million, hopefully, for wastewater and $96 million for on the water side for a total of $133 million.
And what we'll do, Council, is you'll see that number or you'll see the rates related to funding that. And what will happen is that number is significantly less than what we had anticipated even a year ago in our rate forecast. So the good news is that we expect to see a significant amount of savings in the proposed rates when we present those to you in the next week or two.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Find my.
Not yet. He hasn't said anything about our spiffy dressing.
Thank you, Councilmember Fenter. Acknowledge the receipt. Next item, acknowledge receipt of minutes in various boards. We have a motion from Councilmember Summers, second from Vice Mayor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. Hear reports on meetings and our conferences attended. Councilmember Summers.
On Thursday, I'd like to thank Dan Clevenger and Beth Uning for coming out to Southeast Mesa, area of Elliott and Signal Butte, somewhat loosely tied to the presentation we just had. We've had some drainage issues along Signal Butte, close to Elliott Road, particularly at that intersection. Dan and Beth came out and address the concerns of the neighborhood out there. Talked about future plans for constructing new roadways, taking care of drainage issues, gave an update on Fire Station 219, which that news could be better, but it's moving along slowly. So I appreciate your efforts and taking some time to come out there and deal with those issues. Thanks.
Okay. Anything else? Then I will. You're not going to talk about the groundbreaking.
Oh.
Go ahead.
It's just one of those mornings, I guess. Many of us, no kidding. 2-hour meeting is the maximum. The mayor and I, as well as council member Finter and Chris Brady and others, attended the groundbreaking, finally, of the Skyline Aquatics Facility in Southeast Mesa. This is our latest pool. It will be similar to Kino in size and will be sufficient for not only use by the residents in Southeast Mesa, but also to host regional and out-of-state swim competitions. So we do anticipate seeing some national meets coming in and using it to bring some revenue for the city a little bit.
Good. Thank you. Okay. There's nothing else? Oh, yeah. Councilmember Higgins, go ahead.
I did not attend the pool opening groundbreaking. I gave a tour to 30 German exchange students that were here and are at Red Mountain High School. I explained, I gave them a tour of this building and explained city, state, and federal government. So it was a lot of fun. Spent about an hour.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. Just a reminder, tonight District 1 has a Building Stronger Neighborhoods kickoff meeting at 6:30 at Edison Elementary School. And Saturday is a busy day. We have a District 6 pancake breakfast at Fire Station 205, which is on Greenfield. And we also have the grand opening of the Mesa Grande Interpretive Trail, which is at 8 a.m. And they will be having a pancake breakfast also.
Cool.
So.
Just so folks know, apparently they closed Greenfield Road exit. So if you're using the freeway, I would use an alternative route. Dan Clevenger's in the audience if anybody wants to complain. Actually, that's ADOT, right? ADOT closed the road. It wasn't the city of Mesa. So if you use, you can use Southern Road.
Actually, it's our project.
It's our project.
It's a great project, though.
Let me blame the state. I'm sorry. We closed the road. It's temporary, I swear. But for that, I would use Southern Avenue.
But once the road is finished, the closure will seem minor. It'll be much better.
It's going to be absolutely lovely.
Wonderful.
You're going to love it. It's going to move traffic much better.
Yes. Okay. Anything else, Mr. Brady? Okay. Ms. Carter, do we have any requests to speak from the public?
No requests, Mayor.
Thank you very much. We have a motion to adjourn from the Vice Mayor, second by Councilmember Summers. All in favor?
Aye.
We are adjourned. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.